again a poem by William Stafford. I glanced at her and took my glasses off. They were still singing. They buzzed like a locust on the coffee table and then ceased. Her voice belled forth and the sunlight bent. I felt the ceiling arch and knew that nails up there took a new grip on whatever they touched. I am your own way of looking at things, she said. When you allow me to live with you, every glance at the world around you will be a sort of salvation. And I took her hand. Tonight begins the journey into the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth. We have gone quite far in the first half of this year in covering the first three Noble Truths. And the first three Noble Truths set us up, of course, for the fourth, the first three Noble Truths being the recognition that there is pain and conflict, struggle and contraction in our life, and that this contraction has a cause that is self-inflicted, and that it has an ending if we can find the methodology, the way to understand this pain, rather than to keep assuming the pain is coincidental or externally driven. And so the right orientation to the pain is extremely important. And then the third noble truth broadly proclaims the liberation from this pain, which I framed in terms of the liberation from self-belief, because the pain induces a kind of stance or posture to the world that feels very divided and individuated, very separate and very alone. And it's because of the resistance we have to living our life fully that we find ourselves corridored off or cocooned away from life itself. But that essentially is the problem and the solution, but it doesn't give us a practical way to use our life for the resolution of this pain on an ongoing basis. And these next, series and that will last really for the rest of the year and maybe into the next year, I'm not going to try to limit it in any way because it is so important. When I said it was perhaps the most important talk that I will do in the course of this year, I really meant that tonight really holds the cornerstone of the Buddha's liberating proclamation. And may I say that it is for the lay person as well as the monk. In fact, I believe that it's perhaps the most underexplored area of the lay practice in terms of these next series of talks, especially tonight's. It holds the potentiality for each one of us, regardless of our situation, regardless of our purpose, intention, meaning, regardless of whether we find ourselves on retreat or off, or in the throes of parenthood or alone, it doesn't matter. And in fact, if it matters to you, then your life is essentially aspiritual, because if you look across in any way, if you move or glance away from your life with any kind of longing towards a different kind of life, then you have just thrown the possibility, the potentiality for growth away in that glance, in that single, brief, reflective glance. And what we're doing here is establishing a way to hold our life without that glance. That's essential to anything we talk about in the course of our meetings together, this year or in any year. If you glance away from your life, you have simply wasted it spiritually. And many of us, because we have lived within a tradition that encourages reclusive living, retreating, monastic lifestyle, we think that we live a kind of second-class spiritual life as a layperson. And I mean to say, do not hold that belief. It will work so counter to everything that works in Buddhism. And essentially, you're wasting your time in coming here. And it's because I know that in myself that I can hold you firmly to that in my teaching. So the potentiality for every one of us is exactly the same of whether we're on the retreat or off a retreat or whatever we might be doing. Don't lose that understanding. Don't lose that steadiness and that confidence that you are in the right place for whatever you want this meditation to mean to you. Now, I am choosing to make this practice of lay Buddhism a very narrow corridor. I was at a teacher's meeting just last week at the Insight Meditation Society, where all the Vipassana teachers get together once every 3 years. And I was listening to the variety of teaching, and we talked about, including myself, we talked about what our emphasis was. And most Vipassana teachers offer a wide assortment of skillful means and different exercises that you can do given a particular problem. You can do this or that with it. And I said, in my own summation, I said, I don't offer that so much at all. My corridor is very small. Because the more you allow the other forms of activity, the more you build upon the very problem of applying an application to a problem, and you see life as a problem that needs a new application over and over and over again, that really takes you away from the solution. I would rather focus in on how the problem is generated to begin with, rather than solutions to a problem that we haven't even clearly defined. And so tonight I really want this to be the beginning of the first step, perhaps, in understanding where this teaching is pointing, at least in terms of how I'm going to be teaching it. So I'm going to... Wise view. The Buddha said, without wise view, one can aspire towards spiritual growth, but it is like trying to churn water into butter. So he's saying, you know, if this one isn't paramount in your life, then we're really wasting our time. Many people like to cherry pick the Buddha's teaching. They like to say, well, I don't know what wise view is, but let me go to wise speech. That one I can get a hold of. I'll morally ground my speech and hold my words back and not backbite or gossip or talk about people. And I'll feel really good when I do that. And that will be my wise speech. And then I'll do wise action and I'll do wise this and wise that. And I don't know what wise view is. No matter, it's on the top of the list. It's the first step in the Eightfold Path, but I don't really get it. So I'm just going to go ahead and pick 3 or 4 or 5 down there and work on those. It doesn't work that way. We have got to understand this first step because it sets the tone. It's the cornerstone. It sets the entire development and how we hold the other steps of the Eightfold Path. If we don't get this, we will not understand the rest of the journey. This is an extraordinarily important component of the teaching. And the Buddha, he gave us, in the Eightfold Path, he gave us 2 links on proper orientation, this being one of those links. He gave 3 on skillful action, or sila, and he gave 3 on meditation, wise meditation. All of that is held by wise view. So, again, I just keep wanting to emphasize how important this particular topic is. Now, when we have a view of life, that's what we take life to be. That's what our assumptions are. We have a whole basis of assumptions on which we believe this life has a basis. And those assumptions, we don't really test. We just assume them. For instance, when you look out of your eyes, the view you hold is that I'm sitting here and you're sitting there. And there's a whole bunch of assumptions that arise from that view that you hold about your individuation, your individuality, your isolation from me. And then we foster kind of a whole way of orientation to the distinct and discrete objects in our life, usually some kind of manner of grasping at them and bringing them into our life or trying to avoid or push them away. So the way we relate to distinct objects is determined by the assumptions we have made from the view we hold life. However, we've never tested that assumption. We've never asked critical questions about it. And so our growth, especially in spirituality, is going to be in accordance with the view that we hold in life. We will grow in accordance to the view that we have of it. And so if some of you think that you're growing spiritually, yet you maintain this sense of distinct and discrete objects between you and everything else, you may be finding some quite slight modifications in your mind or body's experience. You may find yourself a little calmer, a little quieter, a little more oriented to tranquility or calm. But you're not doing anything about the basic problems, which is the distance that you perceive this and that to be. And that holds and will always instill pain. Always. If you put yourself outside of life and life outside of you, as many of us do, then what has to occur, the inevitability of that view, is going to be pain, because we have wardened ourselves off from the very life that nourishes us. And even though we allow certain things in for slight modification of that life, essentially we will remain unchanged in relationship to it. And it's that relationship to it that is the basic problem that Buddhism is trying to resolve. So you begin to see that how you hold your spiritual life, the way you view life to be, will create your opportunities for growth and will create what you consider to be the result from those opportunities. So your results are also manufactured out of that view. Perhaps you think that liberation from self-belief means that from moment to moment you'll maybe forget about yourself, or that you'll have moments of ease in which our arrogance isn't the predominant experience in the moment. So we'll have moments in which we feel the light breeze or touch of self-absence, but we won't be convinced that self-absence is the state of reality. We'll just think that somehow we have learned in ourselves how to bring forth the chemistry of self-forgetfulness from time to time, yet we'll still be separate in the way we hold our life and our spiritual training. And the techniques we use, every technique has a view associated with it. Unless we understand what we're getting into when we do a skillful means, it will just reinforce that sense of exclusivity, that sense of being cut off and distant from. I hope you're hearing how important this is. If there's one teaching that is vital for spiritual growth, it's this one. Now, either we are separate or we are not. There's no halfway in between. And if we think we are, and that's the assumption we hold, and that's the belief that we have, and we have no willingness to try to see the world in any other way, then we are wasting our time here and in all spiritual pursuits. Simply put. But if we genuinely question, in fact, whether we are separate from other things, whether separation is the given fact of reality, then let us throw our life into that with everything. Let us give over 100% commitment, because it's going to require 100% of us throwing ourselves 100% into the stew of that to change anything. We can't hold part of ourselves back, throw 90% in, and expect anything to change. If we hold one molecule of ourselves back, one atom of belief that we are separate from or distant, then that will create the heaven and hells of our world. It will create the forever distance that we keep perceiving everything from us. And it will give us that nuanced feeling that many of us have, that we're living outside of life, that life is just happening to us in some kind of distant way, and that we're somehow just never really in there, abiding in life at all. Because when we're talking about freedom, we're talking about abiding in life. Life flowing through us as a part of life, not a distinct and separate object that has life and all the other objects have life, so that there's 6 billion lives and lives. It's one life. There's only one reality. And we're an integral part of that reality. And what we have to do to know that is to release our need to feel separate from it. So if we are not separate, and let us just assume that everyone in this room is in accordance with that assumption, that view, that we are not separate from life, because that's what this teaching is going to be about. That's where Sims is moving. That's the small corridor that I'm assuming that people who come are willing to foster and feed in themselves. Then why don't we perceive it? You see, why don't we perceive the unification? Why don't we perceive the oneness? Why does it seem as if life is so problematic, so difficult? So we begin to see that it's how we hold our perceptions that is the problem. Perhaps not basic perception itself. Perhaps not the perception, but the way we perceive. What we build around the perceptions that seem to indicate a perceiver and a perceived. Maybe that's the problem that needs some investigation and questioning. Change how we look and what and who we think is looking. One of the ways that's been very helpful to me, and if you can just see if you can get into this as I speak, give me a feeling, what is looking through the eyes right now, through your eyes? What is looking? Not what are you seeing, but what is looking? So you relax the somebody that thinks they're looking and just let looking look. And you begin to see that if we ask ourselves at that crucial moment, who we are that is looking, the best you can do is say, I don't know. That's the best. Because the looking looks. The looking sees. And from time to time, be able to bring that exercise up. What is it that's looking out of my eyes? And some of you can feel the shift to stillness because it was the noise that thinks it's looking. But as soon as you ask what the looking is, you shift away from the noise to the stillness because the looking has no basis of noise behind it. We make noise in what we see. That's why we rob the perception of its authenticity, of its rawness. The noise of our thinking forms this assumption, only an assumption, that there's somebody looking. And as long as we make noise, it seems rather obvious that I am looking. But just the looking, focusing on just the looking, and the looking will also see the noise that thinks it's looking. And you can see how close the solution to this assumption really is. It's not in a whole 20 years of meditation practice and 30 retreats and 4 years as a monk and. It's in simply changing the figure-ground relationship of the basic assumption of our life. The problem is that the assumption is so indelled, if that's a word. What's the word? Huh? Whatever it is. Embedded in our assumption. It's so conditioned. And it can be so obviously uprooted in a moment of clear seeing. And if the basic reality of life is that it's interconnected and that our assumption of discrete and separate things is false, then that changes the nature of the way we work our meditative and spiritual lives, does it not? If it's just an assumption that things are discrete and separate, then I don't really need to work to get over an assumption. I don't need to make an assumption real by making it a problem and forcing in energetically a solution that is just a view. I need to release my need from having that view. That's all that's necessary. And so all of the hard work and the forced effort that we apply towards meditation is really in the wrong direction. It's in the direction of assuming that the view of separation is real and trying to get over our separation by somehow building a bridge that connects everything, which is impossible to do. If we are separate things, there will be and never can be a bridge of interconnection. How can there be? But there can be if it's just an assumption and that the reality is the interconnection. Then, but I need to work it in a different way. And so that the truth becomes a given rather than something I have to obtain. When I think of something I have to obtain, it's outside of me. It's something I have to work for and towards. But when it's a given, I have to see why it is that I keep assuming something that isn't being seen. And then I work in a very, very different way when I'm oriented in that direction. So you can begin to see how important it is to understand wise view in terms of your meditation practice and in terms of your life and certainly in terms of your spiritual growth. Because the whole orientation to working has to do with the view that we hold. The view of separation is problematic. We see problems that we have to solve and get over. Things to get around, things to, you know, always. But when you begin to understand that the problems are self-generated from that view, change the view. And the problem, the tension is released from that orientation, from when we look, I'll say it in different ways so that people can get a feeling for what I'm talking about, hopefully to bring everybody along here. I don't think it's so hard to understand what I'm saying, at least conceptually or philosophically. But we're asking for more of that. We're asking for each of us to experientially see this. When we perceive through thought, just hear this. Hear this as the logic of this, the spiritual logic. Thought, which is just words of the mind, when you look through a word, the word depicts the reality to hold that particular object. That's what, when you look, it's like looking through red glasses. Everything's going to be red. When you look through thought, then the world is going to hold the piecemeal objectivity of thought. So things, nouns, take on fixed noun relationships. And so everything seems to be so distant when thought accompanies perception. So I'm on to that. I see the limitation of looking at life through thought. Because then all I see is what thought tells me I see. You, me, clock, floor, lamp, chair. That's it. When I can release life from being just what the word says it is. And how do I do that? I see how limiting life is from that vantage point. And when I see that life is limiting from that vantage point, I'm already growing outside of the word and the confiscation of my perception around that word. I feel the tension and the pain of living with just words in my life. And when we get more and more understanding that we just keep holding our living experience to what we have known it to be, meaning the word we have always used for it, and the ideas and assumptions associated with that word, we feel the squeeze, the tight rope around our neck. And we begin to relax. Because why is the word held, the world held by a word? It's because of our need to have it secure and certain. That's what we get out of it. The limitation is that that robs us of it being anything else but that. And so when we see the value of what we get out of it, and we also see the limitation so outweighs the value that we begin to release the tension of the world meaning just what the word says it is. Because it's held together through tension, through it wanting to be that way, through fearing it not being that way. As our fear and desire lessens, suddenly the perception comes out of the word, spreads forth beyond just what the confines of that word is. Lo and behold, it becomes a vast mystery. And also, I know what time it is and where to be at this in that particular moment. So that it's not that I lose the functionality of the relationship. I just see that the functionality in no way embraces the whole. In no way embraces the whole. And I begin to see, you see, there are laws of the mind as there are laws in physics. When you understand wise view, the laws of the mind change. When you understand from unwise view, the sense of you being real and everything else being outside of you, there are certain laws that govern that. Your need to acquire, your need to put distance between you and fear, your need to get over your pain, your need to treat, to control, to self-improve, to influence, etc. Those are laws, psychological laws, that govern that particular unwise stance and view. But in wise view, there is another whole set of laws. And what I'm trying to do, or encourage us, is to move into these wise, this new set of laws, even though your eyes may not yet be telling you the truth. Because they never will tell you the truth if you keep applying the wrong strategies. Apply the wrong strategies, you reassert the old view, unwise view, again and again and again. You can't get out of it by using the strategies from the misperception of what life really is. I have an example that I wanted to mention. I was in Central Texas in 1990 when some madman drove his car into Luby's restaurant. And I was the hospice director, setting up a hospice program. And this guy drives his car to Luby's restaurant and then shoots 23 people in the restaurant, kills people. So it's in our catchment area in the hospice, and everybody is affected by this. It's a small community. Everybody knows someone or something that some sense of grief. And so the next day I was supposed to go to a Kiwanis or some kind of Lions Club or some kind of meeting, Rotary, I think. And I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to bring forth gun control. Just the topic, right? I thought, for God's sake, if people aren't going to know it now, when are they ever going to know it? So we were sitting around the table in this Rotary meeting, having lunch together. And what I was hearing before, thank God, before I opened my mouth to the contrary, was just the opposite. I was hearing conversations of needing to buy guns to protect themselves from these kinds of occasions, as if you would carry a gun into Luby's in case somebody was to crash their car in so that you would have the first shot. And I realized that when you perceive life from the wrong view, there's facts that could be seen in terms of what the wise view would accord are distorted and changed in to reinforcing the very tension of the wrong view that we hold. That's exactly the same way that using strategies of trying to get over, acquire, get through, all of that from wrong view, or any strategies from the assumption that you are not already interconnected, will just create the tension and lead to further proof for you and further deepening a deeper assumption that life is discrete and I might as well get on with my self-improvement. You cannot use thought to end thought. Can't do it. It will provide the perfect logical strategy given the view we hold. Change the view, that strategy has no meaning whatsoever. None. None. Now I want somebody to take your shoulders and shake you here. Because this is about your practice. This is about where you're going to take your practice. This is about your spiritual life. And your life depends upon this. We can't think ourselves out of a problem. That's the mental law of interconnection. You cannot think yourself out of a problem because the problem was induced by thought, thinking we were separate from it. And so using the problem to solve the problem does not work. And if you look at the instructions that have been offered you in meditation, even from the very beginning, hopefully, the instructions were always in alignment, or should have always been alignment, with your non-doing, with stop thinking, with the non-judgment, with allowance, openness, letting be, not with increasing the tension of thought around something. Because those views are so distinct and separate from one another. So I was once with an Advaitist Vedantist Nisargadatta Maharaj in 1980. when he was still alive in Bombay, India. And after, I don't know how many weeks I was there, 2 or 3 weeks, he, in which he really gave me a very, very hard time because I'm so stubborn. It's always been my greatest hindrance. And so after an enormous amount of very difficult conversation between us, one of the final things he said to me was, you know, you can come up and be just, you can come and see just the way I do. Or, and I was a monk when I went to him, you can stay as a monk and work, try to work out your salvation. He says, you never will, but you can continue to try. Or you can just change this assumption you have about the need to do that and rest where I rest. What he was telling me is that I could start from the end rather than the beginning. What he was telling me was that if I held wise view rather than the wrong view of needing to work out my salvation with all of the different methodologies, skillful means, and endless retreats that I did long after that conversation, if I had the end in sight, if I understood interconnection, that deep sense in our heart that every one of us feels or we wouldn't be here, the longing, that deep sense of knowing that somewhere all of this is just nonsense, this discrete and separate thingness. You get a feeling for that once in a while. I know you do. And the agony, the continual burden of perpetuating that story of isolation. If I were just to connect with that, as if life were worth living from, it really isn't worth living, you know. You can't fault people who kill themselves under that view, because simply life is not worth living from the idea and assumption of separation. I mean, if it were worth living, maybe there's a choice there, but it's not. So what do we have to lose? And joining, to hell with it. No, let's just get in there. And it just happens to be true. That makes it really nice. So we're not just pretending. Because you can go so far with pretending, but then reality will dawn on us. But what happens is that as you begin to invite interconnection, you see the mystery working for you. You've seen that, haven't you? You just have an idea or a thought or a desire and you just turn around and it's suddenly there. The coincidence of meeting, all the chances that occur in life. Random act of discrete beings bumping into each other. I doubt it. 6 billion billiard balls. It's a crowded table. But there's this sense of mystery that has been foretold since time immemorial. And we read in the books the prophet's words, and something inside of you ignites. What inside of you ignites? That which already knows conclusively that you are not separate. And so to work in conjunction, even though the mind, you see, because we have given the mind such a throned position in our life. The mind will always betray that intuitive understanding. It will don't wait for the mind to come along with what your heart intuitively knows. Because its job is not to do that. Its job is for you to be able to navigate through the world, to put food in your mouth, to get what you need to get. To do that, it has to see things as such, to procure them. So the mind has a particular purpose and point so that you'll get out of the way of the charging lion and not say oneness. So it's not to object to what the mind is doing. It's just not to put the reality totally in the door of the mind. To begin to feel the sensory data, the cellular. You see, you won't feel it up here. You'll feel it here. You'll feel it in the body, right now, in the body. Sense it. In the body, sense it. You sense it from the body. It has a physical resonance. And so we need to challenge what we have made assumptions with from unwise view. We need to challenge that, especially our emotions. Our emotions, our betrayals, our mental confiscations around what the brain tells us we see. He's doing that to me. It's a whole interpretation. And so the thought is all screwed up and wrong and projected. And then an emotional charge comes around the thought, all falsely based upon unwise view. Rather than doing that, first connect with the emotion. Connection begins the turnaround, the great turnaround. Connecting with all those emotions which tell you to run, to disconnect further, to make yourself more separate. You know, impatience, frustration, annoyance, loneliness, sadness, grief, anger, fear. And I do not believe them. I just don't believe them. I'm not going to allow my life again and again to be disconnected from the assumptions that this emotion is making on life. And cut myself off even further. So I'm just not going to do that. And so my resolution of the heart is towards using the very things that cut me off, and I call this reversed cues. The very things that seem to cut me off further and isolate me more are now the very food for my inner connection. Okay? Let me just feel it. Just feel this. I will not allow it to separate myself more. So first I have to connect to it. Any kind of disconnection, especially the disconnection from the emotion itself, will just set up an abyss that cannot be crossed. Once I connect with the emotion, I'm still connected to that which seemed to condition the arising of the emotion. And so I don't leave anything out of my heart. Nothing. And so I practice non-resistance. The way of wise view is the way of non-resistance, releasing the tension that's inherent in discrete things knocking into each other. And the protection and defensiveness and the inhibition and all of that. Just restart releasing the need to put distance between anything, to overcome that distance, all that's necessary, because there's no distance in reality, remember, is to release the psychological resistance that I have given, the boundary that I have placed between myself and this thing. The boundary is just an assumption and a psychological intervention between something. It is not there in reality. So because it's not there in reality, it can be easily fixed. by releasing the tension, relaxing and releasing the tension between you and anything and everything. And then the orientation. Then we're starting to move in proper orientation to wise view. But remember, the cues, the aversive responses are so strong, the conditioned responses are so strong to place the blame of our pain outside of ourselves in that discrete object, rather than in the assumption we're making about the world, that it takes a long time for us to see, oh my God, what have I been doing? This is about me, and my projection has nothing to do with you. Now I've seen it, that's it. How many times do I have to see it? How much proof is enough? And we get excited about this. There's joy in coming, bringing it all back together so that it starts making sense. Words like learning and receptive, being receptive. You see, when you're listening, questioning, receptivity, listening breaks down our self-posture, right? When you're not listening, you're opinionating, you're very distinct and separate from something. But as soon as you really listen, you have to listen without the opinion, suddenly you're connected. Duh. What did you do? You did nothing but release the need to think. When you release the need to think and really listen, you find yourself connected. So you begin to see that the absence of something proves the connection. The addition of something makes the assumption of disconnection. Like questioning. Questioning breaks down fixation. When we feel we're fixed somewhere, if we just question, we just look at it, we look at it, move towards it, release the resistance to it, suddenly we find ourselves fully embodied with it. Or taking a posture of receptivity in general, which breaks down the need to control, which is what discrete objects do to one another. They try to out-control the other. When we release our need to control, things come back in. You see, if it were the other way around, then you would be disproving wise view. But the fact that when we release something, we make the experiment more pure. We just see organically what is there. Rather, no add-ons here. No subjectivity. Release the subjectivity. What is life like? If it's connected and interconnected, then that's its given. If in the subjective it becomes discrete, then you know it's false. Things like the precepts. You see, the precepts are all guidelines for releasing the tension to life, so that we live in accordance to wise view. Non-harm is how we live when we see things are interconnected. So when we start seeing that we're harming things, that's a cue that we're under the wrong assumptions about life. So all we have to do is say, oh, wait a second here, I've got the wrong view going. Let me come back into full accord. And that's what the Buddhist teaching is meant to do in all of its different expressions, is to be reminders to us that we are assuming something that isn't true about life. Come back in. Align ourselves in the right way. Good and evil. It's all the thing. It's all one. It's all whole. It's all of that dissipates in union. It was just the mind doing it to things. The mind's label on things. The mind's discord, not life's. I had a hospice patient. I'm going to talk a little longer tonight, if you don't mind. It's such an important talk. There's a hospice patient, and he was kept having nightmares about death, and he found himself running. He would have a picture of death being personified as some kind of creature or something, and he found himself having nightmare after nightmare where he was trying to get out of the way of it. And then I would visit him, and he would tell me about those nightmares. And I said, okay, well, let's just start talking about death, because I could see there was so much fear and terror associated with us. So we had these long conversations about death, and he actually got very interested in what death might be. And we kept having these conversations over time. And then one night, he had the dream, and he started to find himself running from how death was manifesting in that dream. And he got curious, and he turned towards death, and he says, "What are you really?" And that dream dissipated, the nightmare dissipated. He never had another nightmare associated with that particular topic. That willingness to turn towards, rather than just following the logic of your brain, which says run from the lion. We move with the facts. We look at the facts for what they are, not what the mind tells us them. We see, we feel. We make no assumptions about anything, because any assumption is self-driven. And then wise you begins to unfold. It begins to be encouraged in the very body, speech, and mind of our actions, in the very samadhi and mindfulness of our practice. I'm just showing you the rest of the Eightfold Path. And each then reinforces the next. And so view, intention, effort, action, speech, body, mind, all of it in cooperation with the truth rather than in discord. And when it's all lined up, you don't need anybody talking to you about this. It's so clear. So understood. Your way is so well known and fearless. You just keep turning to death. But watch out, and you turn towards that. But watch out, and you turn towards that. And life takes on a completely different reference than it is now. It does not hold the pain that it does now, because we no longer create the resistance to life that creates the problem. And we grow exponentially, not arithmetically, geometrically. Because it's never true in the first place. Never. Not one instant of it all. It's a bad dream. We've been held under the trance of thought. And we know what wise view is. We know, not as a probability or a possibility, but as a given, because the cells of our body have always been in alignment and resonant with that. And we've just been looking in the wrong place. We've been looking through our eyes. And they've clouded things, confused things, thrown us off course. So my wish is for all of us to join in this small corridor of life and truly make it worth living through the application of this wise view. Thank you. Can we sit for a moment or two? So as you sit, how do you sit? Do you have a problem? Is there a problem in your sitting? Release the tension to have a problem or the need for a problem. Don't keep looking for excuses to define yourself. Why can't it just be the way it is? Why does there have to be any tension with it at all? So if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to do my best. We only have a few minutes here. Yes.
It seems like when we hold on to the wrong view, it's because we think somehow that we can still have our way.
We can still have our cake and eat it too. Yes, he said that when we hold on to a wrong view, we do so because we still want our way. The basic need to control is at the heart of wrong view, right? We just refuse to surrender what we willfully think we can expect from life, what we deserve from life. It's worse than that. It's our right. We should have it this way, and life should not have to be so unpleasant. And yet it is. If you just look at the basic argument, it's like saying this shouldn't be. Never mind that it shouldn't be. It is. It is. The isness is what. Go for the isness, not the should be-ness. I mean, what do you want? Reality? You want reality or you want should be? If you want should be, you'll live forever in the confines of your mind, because the mind is a should-be machine. And it will should-be everything. And so as long as you live in the should-be, your life will be tormented, because it won't be. If it would follow you, I don't know, somehow, it just seems like it's so obvious sometimes. I mean, if it worked, okay, this should be warmer, and it would happen, or cooler, or something. But that's fairyland. It's Hollywood romanticism. But when it shouldn't be any particular way at all, then it is. Now what are you going to do? Well, if you move from is, you move into should be. There's only two things, should be or is. So begrudgingly, we have to fall into is. And that changes everything. Suddenly, it's not a problem. There's only a problem when there was a should be and an is. When there's a should be and an is, shouldn't be. But when we release shouldn't be, there's just is, so there's no problem. It's not as if the mind continues to should be, it's is. It gives up is. It lets it go conceptually completely, so there's no other frame of reference but what is, and therefore there's no resistance to it. should be is wrong view. It's I have a problem with life. Because I'm outside of it, I get to wish, have wish fulfillments in relationship to it. But if we're connected, it makes no sense at all. I don't want to be a left hand. Makes no sense at all. So really look at this thing. Get it so deep inside of you that you have no left hand speaking. So this is ridiculous, because really you can begin to see it as that. And if you can't see it as that, it's because you're looking through the brain's door. And the brain is going to tell you that you have every right to your fantasy. You do if you want to be in pain, you have a perfect right to your fantasy. But if you want out of your pain, then you have to self-correct. So some of us haven't had enough pain so that we realize that we really need to self-correct, or the pain we still think is being done to us. Those are the choices. And as long as both of those choices you play out, you'll play out the history of humankind since time immemorial. And you'll war, and you'll argue, and you'll fight, and you'll contract, and be in conflict. It has to be that way. It's not as if you can be a separate object and then have a Plutonic world. You can't. It's going to be like the world has been. Righteousness versus righteousness. That's the only way it can be. From wrong view. And the point is that wrong view gets our attention because it hurts so darn much. And you see the disaster in front of you and you say, God, this doesn't work. And you think, well, maybe there's something else. And then you get interested in another possibility. But the pain has been used, is used, to incite the sense of being fed up. I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And at that point, when you really see it, you see that's what the whole thing is. There's work to do for all of us. Find out where it is that you don't see it and look what you aren't seeing. Look at what you're not seeing. Don't pretend or deny anything. Be willing to look at what you're not facing. If you're willing to look at what you're not facing, then you'll orient yourself to the facts of life, and the facts will teach you about their interconnectedness. But if you're oriented to facts as facts that can be denied or defended, then you will cut yourself off from your lifeblood and be in pain through that resistance. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about letting go of the excuse to define yourself?
The need to define yourself? Mm-hmm. Letting go of the need to define oneself. You can work it one of two ways. You can work it in letting go of the need to define things, and then you won't be defined because you're defined through things. Or you can let go of the need to be defined as a person, and then things won't be defined because they're mutually defined. If you work it, the easiest way is to work it through yourself and say, what is this thing? What is looking through my eyes? You begin to see that there's two things. There's awareness and there's thought. And when I let the awareness go through thought, it seems as if I am looking, because thought defines discrete objects, and therefore there's a discrete subject among the discrete objects looking outward. There has to be two when you see things. But when you look at what is looking, which is awareness, awareness is undivided and therefore makes no division or separation at all. And so thought cannot, because awareness is essentially stillness, nothing is undivided in stillness. what is looking through our eyes in this moment? What is looking? What is looking? And you can feel it. I mean, I don't know how you cannot feel it. It's like the elephant in the middle of the room here. If you just allow yourself to relax a little bit, what's he saying? He's not going to, I'm not going to listen to all of that stuff. I'm not trying to do anything to you. All I'm trying to do is to get you relaxed. If you don't want to relax, I don't know what you're doing here. So just relax. Relax the need for the world to be a certain way. Relax your angst. Relax your righteousness. Relax your anti-Bush fervor. You know what happens when you relax? You smile. Because it wasn't, it's like, wow, my God, what have I been missing here? You see, wise view is not another view. It's stillness. The end of wording is wise view. The end of wording. Okay, so we have to have announcements now. Thank you so much.